I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 200 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us, please go to caropop.com. Paul Myers recently posted the 200th episode of his Record Store Day podcast, so we thought, hey, let's celebrate our 200th with him. There are so many entry points with this guy. Years ago, I read a fascinating book, A Wizard, A True Star, Todd Rundgren in the Studio, that goes deep into Rundgren's evolution as an artist and producer. Later, I discovered the Record Store Day podcast with Paul Myers, on which he brings his smarts, musical experience, and sense of humor to lively interviews with mostly music people. Some of them have also been guests here. Myers has excellent taste. At some point, I made the connection that he was the guy who'd written that excellent Rundgren book, and happens to be the older brother of actor-writer Mike Myers, whom I interviewed for the Chicago Tribune back when the first Austin Powers movie was coming out. Paul Myers is proudly from Toronto and now lives in Northern California. He also has written books about the Canadian rock band Bare Naked Ladies, British musician Long John Baldry, and the Canadian comedy troupe Kids in the Hall. His new book, John Candy, A Life in Comedy, celebrates and mourns one of Canada's and Hollywood's most impactful stars. It's an inspirational story and a cautionary tale. It makes you laugh in recollection of Candy's work on Second City Television and in movies such as The Blues Brothers, Splash, Spaceballs, Cool Runnings, and especially Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Belle.
Oh.
Oh. Why did you kiss my ear?
Why are you holding my hand?
Where's your other hand?
Between two pillows.
Those aren't pillows.
It also makes you cringe at the way filmmakers exploited his weight for sight gags, such as the wrestling scene in Stripes, and how that made Candy feel.
You might have noticed I've got a slight weight problem.
No.
Yeah, I do.
No.
Yeah, I do. Anyway, I went to this doctor, and well, he told me I swallowed a lot of aggression, along with a lot of pizzas.
He talks about roles he didn't take, including one in particular that would have been so cool. And it breaks your heart in chronicling this generous, funny man's struggles with issues that would shorten his life. Myers discusses the duty he felt in researching and writing John Candy, A Life in Comedy, and whether he was aware of Colin Hanks's documentary, John Candy, I Like Me, that wound up being released in close proximity to the book. He also weighs the role of addiction in Candy's life as well as his own. We flash back to Paul Myers' early years. He grew up in Toronto with parents from Liverpool who loved Peter Sellers, Monty Python, and the Beatles. Mike Myers told me years ago that he grew up thinking he and his brothers were related to the Beatles. Paul expands on that idea and tells of his pursuit of music, then journalism, and how he became someone who can do it all. Having worked in radio and television, he now writes, produces, engineers, hosts, and composes the music for the Record Store Day podcast. Speaking of Record Store Day, Myers offers his prime picks for RSD Black Friday coming November 28th. And of course, one podcaster to another, we talk a bit of shop. Honestly, I could have chatted with him all day. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Paul Myers. Well, let's start with your new book, because John Candy, A Life in Comedy, I really like enjoyed it, but it also made me sad. You know, it's like a comedy book that makes you laugh because you remember all these great moments, but then is there something so bittersweet about it? Like was that your experience writing it?
Yeah. I sort of felt it was a solemn responsibility to chronicle why somebody was so great and why it hurt when they were gone. And so there was a solemnness to my approach. I had no agenda other than the fact that it had to be as close to the truth as anyone can get, using anecdotal information and firsthand testimony from people. So a little like a detective. I found by the time I got to his passing, you'll notice there's something like three, maybe four chapters that deal with his loss. You know, the actual moment of him dying in Mexico, the telling the family, the repercussions within show business and his general public, and then his legacy. There's a, you know, and it's hard when you're speaking of someone who's famous for being large, but there was a large absence, not just a physical thing, but his passing hurt everybody for different reasons, his family, obviously, most of all. But he he spent most of his life trying to make things better for everyone, including himself. He enjoyed being funny. He enjoyed making people laugh, but he was doing it so that there would be some light in a world that could potentially be dark. And I get into that too.
Sure.
That his, you know, being, losing his father when he was only 5 years old and being raised by two women and having to be somewhat the man about the house, you know, man of the house. And then he was like that with everybody. He was a nurturer, but he also stood up for himself. So the other expression I keep thinking of is when you carry everyone up all the time, your shoulders are going to hurt, you know? And I think the anxiety and the panic that he had in the later part of his life came from being a people pleaser and being there for people, which he, again, almost pathologically needed to connect with people. He wanted to help people. He wanted to meet people. He liked people. But he, you know, he maybe had an expense. It had an expense on him,
right?
And yeah, so
it's
so,
like his generosity cost him. It seems,
yeah, amongst other things, and congenital heart issues as well.
Sure.
I mean, there's a lot of things that, you know. Again, I always become a rap during these interviews, but I always say I am not Dr. Paul Myers, so I can't give you the conclusive, but I can give you a lot of anecdotal and researched and, you know, things that I know and things he said, things he actually said towards the end of his life in interviews about wishing he had started therapy earlier, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I just had the episode I just posted is with Peter Guralnick, who wrote The Colonel and the King about Colonel Tom Parker and wrote his two Elvis things. And John Candy and Elvis, I mean, people always sort of group together like John Candy and John Belushi and Chris Farley because they were these overweight, oversized, you know, personalities who we lost way too early. And he wasn't Elvis, because he was much more, you know, functional than Elvis. But there was this sort of sense with both of them that they had like a lot of people they were trying to please all the time, and they were generous to a fault, as we talked about. They were struggling with these sort of addictions as well, and also struggling with loss. You know, Elvis with his mother, which was later in life. John yeah. Candy with his father, but that all that there's kind of these sad, I don't know, things that just kind of went together for both of them, even though obviously they're, you know, John Candy's not Elvis.
It's funny you should be talking to Peter, because Peter Guralnick is on 2 weeks from now. He's on my show. We recorded it a while ago. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think you and I tend to mine the same seams. So, yeah.
You have excellent taste.
Well, I also decided to put all my book episodes for when I'm on the my own book tour. So I thought it was just kind of a nice way of getting. Anyway, that's a bit of shop talk. But
I want to talk shop with you, too. So this is good.
But what's interesting is, yeah, I also picked up on that. I think having plumbed the depths of the Candy story for 3.5 years, I feel like I see it in a lot of other, like you were saying, another stories. Like Elvis might not be the exact same story, but definitely it humanized that book that he wrote, humanized the Elvis and Colonel Tom relationship the same way that I was hoping to humanize John Candy. So you can see him as a legend. You can see him as, you know, the shorthand that he was a nice man. Everyone loved him. But now we see why it mattered. And we also see where the films that didn't work, you see what he was looking for, why he did that. And
right.
And I find myself being kinder to a lot of the mistakes because of it. Like, you know, like Nothing But Trouble, the Dan Aykroyd film he made, which Dan, you know, considered Dan's big sort of
right.
flop, you know, but it swung at the fences. That film went hard, as they say. And John really loved Dan Aykroyd and played two parts in this movie. And people said, why did he do that movie? And I'm like, if you were beholden to Dan Aykroyd the way Dan Aykroyd had been for him, Aykroyd was there for him at pretty much every major juncture in his career, including his funeral. And there, that is one example I'm isolating about. Now I understand things about that I didn't know going in, you know?
Right. And he does so many projects where he's sort of loyal to the same people. So he's working with Eugene Levy and, you know, Joe Flaherty and just, you know, all these Second City people and just kind of, you know, working with this crew, even if the script maybe isn't in as great a shape as it should be. I guess the other Elvis parallel would be, and again, these all kind of tenuous, in that that both of them live pretty expensive lifestyles, again, often treating other people to all this. And so there was this need to maybe work more than there would have been otherwise. And so like in the you know, Colonel Parker book, which you've seen, it's you know, part of the reason he had so many movies and so many deals was to, because Elvis needed money and John Candy needed money, and he had his, you know, investment in the Argonauts and everything else. So there's kind of this treadmill that he was on, and reading your book and just being reminded of the volume of movies that he was doing, you're just like, oh, you know, if he could have just like done fewer and made him count more, that would have been great. But he was on this different treadmill, right?
Yeah, I think you'll find in stories of actors in general, like Michael Caine takes a lot of movies too.
Oh, yeah.
Like, so I think sometimes actors, especially when they start out not getting parts, once they start getting offered things and they think, well, you know, I could just picture Michael Caine, for instance, saying, you know, I've got 6 weeks off and they're shooting in Mallorca, you know, like, let's just do it, you know, and it's a little bit like, this fills up my schedule. You know, this keeps me busy until the next year. And then there's, I think, a very real thing that happens with people. They want to make sure their name is still in the movies, you know. So they just to be in a cast like an ensemble picture, like Once Upon a Crime, it might have been like, well, you know, it's another name in the poster, so everyone knows I'm still here. You know, like, I can't speak for him, but I, it's a favor, Eugene Levy, and there's, you know, I picture if John had lived, he would have probably been a regular or semi-regular on Schitt's Creek with, you know, Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara, because that's how those people roll, you know?
Right. Yeah, and I mean, like, Wagons East was something that came out of what sounded like a much better project falling through, and he had to do it, which is frustrating. Mm-hmm. And then I honestly, part of it really pained me when I read, because I hadn't heard this before, that he was offered the role of Mr. Wolf in Pulp Fiction turned it down. And I'm like, wait, Pulp Fiction with John Candy in that role? I mean, Harvey Keitel, he's great, but
yeah, Harvey Keitel's fantastic, but yeah,
that would have been a different spin on that. And it would have been so fun to see him in a movie like that.
You know, I didn't believe it when somebody said, oh, ask, when you're talking to this guy who works for John Candy, ask them about the Pulp Fiction script. And I was like, why? They said, because he was offered it. And Tarantino loved him in a film called The Clown Murders, which was a Canadian movie. Tarantino loves all levels of film. And he always, you know, and he always likes to cast sort of the guy you wouldn't suspect. You know, and, you know, I mean, he brought Travolta back in that film. So it was like he was trying really hard to keep that going, and could only imagine. I think, as it turns out, it was verified by about three different people I talked to that, yes, they had seen the script on Candy's desk and that there had been talks. But what it was that it was a violent, violent and maybe some sexual stuff in it that he just thought he had been working so hard to have this middle of the road sort of career at that point, although he did do JFK, but that wasn't a violent part for him,
right?
You know, so I think there was just,
he was kind of
much.
A cleanup artist in Mr. Wolf is cleaning up the mess in Pulp Fiction. So he's there's no violence, but it's the aftermath of it, certainly.
And maybe he just didn't want to be in a scene where somebody's saying, you know, dead N-word storage, you know, like, I mean, like, literally there's a lot of offensive stuff in that scene.
That's the one thing that kind of doesn't hold up in that movie, honestly, is that dialogue that Tarantino wrote for himself.
He tries too hard. I'm pretty sure he wrote it for himself because no one else would say it. But anyway, look, I digress. I have a lot of respect for Tarantino as a filmmaker and a writer of films. But yeah, there are definitely moments where I would, you know. So, but let me say back to this. I think Candy could have done something like a Good Will Hunting. You know, not to say he would have done Robin Williams' part in that, but he was never offered it or anything. But a film like that where he plays, you know, this, you know, mentor to somebody. I mean, in some ways, Cool Runnings, not the same at all, but Cool Runnings, he played a mentor to this Jamaican bobsled team, which put him in a situation in real life of being the most experienced actor on the set. And all those young cast members say that he was the real coach, you know. And so that was kind of a serious role for him in a lighthearted family comedy that, strangely enough, did very well at the box office because it had that Mighty Ducks quality to it, which it was a, you know, inoffensive, amusing, and also full of heart, you know.
Underdog story. And
everyone loves an underdog story, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm guessing you would agree with me, but like comedy is harder than drama in general. And the fact that, you know, someone like John Candy could do, you know, his role in JFK, or Robin Williams could do Good Will Hunting, or Bill Murray could do Lost in Translation, it's because you need to, in order to be able to do comedy, you need to be able to connect with those emotions. And so it, like one of the many losses you have with John Candy is the roles that he would have gotten that would have been, you know, aside from the, you know, the funny, jolly guy who you love, you know, see how he would have played against it like he did in JFK.
Absolutely. And you know, I have quotes in there from Oliver Stone where he says, you know, look out for this guy. He's going to be a serious dramatic actor. And, you know, basically speculating that he would be on the red carpet for the Oscars at some point. And he was offered things like the role of Ignatius T. Riley in A Confederacy of Dunces, the most famously unfilmable jinxed right. film ever.
Yeah, never going to happen, I guess.
I think there's been like seven or six at least different mountings of this, and several of the people who were supposed to play that role died.
Philip Seymour Hoffman was attached to it at some point, I think, or they were trying to get him, I think.
I mean, the last I heard, they were trying to do it with Will Ferrell, and I was thinking his doctor should tell him no, you know?
Right.
It's just, that would have been a very interesting turn for him. And then there's this action film with Sylvester Stallone that I didn't know about that John Hughes was supposed to make called Bartholomew versus Neff. And it was kind of a, you know, two neighbors. One guy's a disgraced sports star. I think it was Stallone. And they have a, you know, kind of a battle over their fence, you know. And it was supposed to be like this action film with Sylvester Stallone and John Candy. And it was a comedy action film. Stallone wanted to do comedy. Candy wanted to branch out into something that wasn't just, you know, lovable character guy. And Hughes was going to direct it. And then Hughes decides not to direct it. And then he pulls out of the film altogether. Then Stallone pulls out. And that's how he ends up in Carolco Pictures offered him a contract breaker. Basically, if you do this film for us, you're out. We'll let you go. And the film was Wagons East.
Right, exactly.
So,
which is
so
tragic,
this is just so. Like, I mean, it's just all around. It's tragic. It's just it's you would think, too, that he would have been able to find a conflict resolution that didn't involve him going to Durango to shoot this comedy that wasn't the Blazing Saddles that they hoped it would be, you know?
Right. One of the other things that's painful in reading this, aside from, you know, his addictions and, you know, just breaking of his diet and all that, but just the way that he was self-conscious about his weight and the way that was used on screen in ways that you look back on and you're like, yeah, that wasn't really sensitive. You know, it's like Harold Ramis, great writer, everything else. But, you know, you look back on that, the wrestling scene in Stripes, and it's a little like, I don't know about that, you know? And he was obviously uncomfortable with that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, what was interesting to me is I spoke with the late Ivan Reitman, who put that all together. And you know, just before he passed away, actually, it was literally 2 weeks before he passed away. And he told me that he didn't know. He claimed to not remember any resistance to it, and that he felt like, you know, so maybe what I learned from that is that the people pleaser John just said, okay, but I don't like it, but you know, I'll do it. And that all that Ivan remembered was, yeah, he did it. But meanwhile, Joe Flaherty and Dave Thomas, who had been with him at Second City Stage before SCTV, they were on that set too, and they remembered it being different. They remembered it being very humiliating for John. So, and I'm sure it was, to be honest. I just want to clarify something. I know we're speaking about addictions, but just so that the audience knows, his main addictions were eating too much and drinking too many rum and cokes. And just, I'm not saying that that's not bad for you. It's definitely bad for you. But I would say that in the times he was in, he dodged the cocaine bullet. He dodged heroin. He was not John Belushi. And, you know, and by the way, even John Belushi was a much more disciplined actor than people remember. But it's just very tricky because I know that John himself hated the book Wired and actually also hated the movie.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
But anyway,
And one of the reasons he didn't do the story of Fatty Arbuckle, aside from the obvious, was that it was another story, you know, sort of like scandalizing and tabloid fodder, you know. And so I just want to make sure that everyone knows that, you know, Candy did overindulge, but he was addicted to a lot of things, and some of them weren't necessarily some of them were like just addicted to kindness, you know, like addicted to being there for people. Like he really got a buzz out of connecting with people. I'm not saying, again, I'm not saying he had some unhealthy habits, but they weren't, you know, it didn't consume him that way. And he showed up for work, which is, I know the rationale. I'm an alcoholic, so I can speak about how I have to say I can't drink at all, because even if I did show up for work, I would be still a guy who drinks too much, you know, like it's just, but I would say that Candy, most people knew he liked to have too many drinks late at night, but he got the work done and he was there for his family. And I think that I would have liked to have seen him live healthier in terms of also eating steaks in the middle of the night. But, you know, what are you going to do? You know, I mean, we can't relitigate something that happened over 40 years ago now.
Right. Yeah, I think the term addictions, years ago, you would have assumed it was some sort of drug thing. And now I think that we have a broader sense of,
yes,
you know, food, alcohol. You don't use the word alcoholic in the book, as I recall. I did wonder, it makes it appear that he was one, but I, you know, it's not, I mean, maybe you don't need to label it, but it seems that
I would say that for me, alcohol dependency in my case, for instance, you know, that I think of that as the classic alcoholic. I think there's a lot of Irish people in my family line who, you know, would consider having a pint a day or six pints a day, and they would not say alcoholic. But nowadays, by modern standards, we'd say that's a lot of alcohol, my friend. So that's probably why if I didn't use the term, it's also because I don't know if it was the same. I think he just didn't know when he didn't. I don't think he was addicted to the actual chemical. I think he liked the lifestyle. I think for him, getting off work was to go have a big meal and drink a bit, you know, and that's a Canadian thing more than anything else. And again, we are so much better nowadays about understanding mental health and understanding physical health.
Sure.
I know so many more musicians now who are sober like me, and, you know, and it's not a big deal to talk about it. We're not buzz killing anyone to say, yeah, I don't do that, you know. And you know, I can tell you from my point of view, by the way, I would never be anywhere now if I hadn't quit 28 years ago. So we have a much better understanding today about excessive anything, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, there would be programs that John Candy would maybe be entering for rehab, but whether it's the food stuff or the alcohol or all of the above, that seemed like that wasn't on the table at the time.
Yeah. He might've just tired of it. He might've just said, you know, I'm tired of getting hungover, you know, like, let's just move on. And that's what happened to a lot of people. I'm not going to name names, but I remember reading other stories where people say, yeah, I used to drink a lot more than I don't do that now, you know?
This John Candy documentary, John Candy, I Like Me, is, I think it debuts today on Amazon Prime.
Yeah,
was that something that was in production while you were working on this? Was there any sort of awareness of these parallel tracks?
You know, that film was the elephant in the room throughout the entire process. So the weird thing is we independently, something like 4 years ago, Doug Richmond, my editor at House of Anansi Press, who did my Kids in the Hall book, he said, hey, we love the book, the Kids in the Hall book. It's doing great for us. Everyone's really happy with the book and how it's doing. We'd like to keep working with you. What else do you want to do? And I'm like, you know, by the way, as a writer, like, when do you get that call?
I know,
kicking doors down after kicking doors down for so long. And somebody says, hey, you want to take that cigarette and light another one with it? I'm like, sure. So I said, you know, I would love to do a book. While I was doing the Kids in the Hall, I said, oh my God, you know, the mother load of Canadian sketch comedy is SCTV. And I said, the problem is, and you'll laugh because I said, Martin Scorsese's gotten there first and he's putting out a documentary that will probably take up all the oxygen and, you know, to use a There Will Be Blood analogy, it will drink my milkshake, you know, like, and there's no way there'll be anything left for me to talk about. And then of course that film never materialized, but in the interim, he said, you know, if you just did John Candy from SCTV, you could then go on to talk about his film career. And, you know, it's a Canadian publisher, so they also understood the national, you know, the national prominence of John Candy to our consciousness as Canadians. And so I just went, oh, could I do that? And it was really, it was like almost left field. I was like, wow, a book about John Candy, who knew I would do that? And then I had sort of social media contacts with Jen Candy, his grown daughter, Jennifer Candy Sullivan. And I emailed her and I said, as is my way when I'm doing a book, like with Todd Rundgren, I immediately emailed Todd and said, will you participate? And, you know, with other people, I've done that. You know, the kids in the hall, I only did it when they said they would all talk to me. And she said, oh, you know, we know who you are and we think you're obviously somebody we trust and you're from the Second City family. We understand. But I got to tell you, we're working on our own, probably a movie. It's going to be a family thing using family footage and our story told by us. And it's a different focus. And so we're going to save all of our stuff for that. And at this point, I knew nothing about Ryan Reynolds being involved in something. And then he announced that I love John Candy and I can't wait to share something I've been hoping to do. And I just like, you know, I'm like Columbo. I get it now. Here's what's going on. and then I you know, obviously I made inquiries, but I don't know with, you know, how things never get up the chain. And so I knew that the Candies weren't going to participate, you know, they gave their blessings to me, but I knew I'd have to go on my own. I started getting a lot of interviews and I thought I should at least get Ryan Reynolds. And I don't know, we never did. And then I heard Colin Hanks was involved, and I'm a huge fan of his documentaries, by the way. He did All Things Must Pass, the Tower Records story.
Hmm.
Really, you know, as the Record Store Day podcast guy, it was really up my street, and having spent time at the in many different towers. And then he did the Eagles of Death Metal film, which is a terrible tragedy at the Bataclan. And he did, I think, a very respectful film about that. So I thought, wow, he's doing the John Candy film. So they're going to be good. I have no idea when they're coming out at this point. A year, I'm going to tell you there's a little bit more to this story. A year ago, more or less, we were almost ready to publish, like it would have been ready for 2024. Backing further up, I would have had to have done a couple of edits to make it work for that date. And I said, oh man, I think I want to change the whole structure. And my editor agreed and he said, why don't we just not make, they were really excited about it so far, but it was way too long and all these things. And they said, why don't we just give ourselves a year and put it out in 2025 when we have it the way we want it, you know? And I thought, wow, that's nice. That's it's bad because you're waiting and waiting and waiting. So 4 years after inception, we finally knew that October 7th, 2025 was going to be our date. Then I see in the summer that the Ryan Reynolds, Colin Hanks film is streaming October 10th. I thought, that's really, you know, and it's the 75th anniversary. It would have been the 75th birthday of John Candy this year. So all this sort of zeitgeist got together, I think. And I have since heard from Ryan Reynolds, you know, so he's like, so, you know, we saluted each other in some exchanges. And, you know, I'm actually going to meet them at some point. And it's going to be really nice because now we're just candyologists, you know. And I feel like it's kind of nice the way it's all come together. So, you know, I'm supporting them. They're supporting me. So it's cool.
You guys could get on some panels together. I had some I had discussions on a totally other project where there was a possibility of a documentary and a book that I was trying to get to going. And we really had this kind of ongoing argument of me taking the position of one will help each other and the other was being sort of zero-sum game about it. But I'm of the mind still that it's like if you read the book, you'll want to, you know, you want to go back and see his movies and his clips and stuff like that. And if you see, you know, a documentary about him, you're going to want to get the depth that you provide in the book. So I'm hoping that Rising Tide will lift both your boats. Cause I think, you know, great. You know, people are focusing more on John Candy. And if you hear about one, you should check out the other one.
You know, this zeitgeist thing can't be underestimated in terms of, you couldn't have, even a cynical marketing ploy wouldn't have pulled it off this well, which is the LA Times, for instance, does a really lovely feature about my book that's also a lovely feature about Colin Hanks's film and basically speaks about it as a moment in time and a culture. And so if we had planned to do that, slipstream each other, I don't think it would have worked that way. I think there's something organic. And also because both projects, I think, are honest projects from, you know, with no agenda. We really just wanted to tell the story and share the news about John Candy. And I think as hokey as that might even sound, I think it's absolutely true. And it's there's a lot of stuff I have to say about empathy and kindness being really needed right now. And I think everyone's responding to that too. Isn't it nice to talk about somebody who wasn't, you know, who wasn't cruel?
Yes, like, absolutely. No, I mean, it's funny. You read the book and you're just like, You know, I'm still waiting for someone to say, oh, that guy was a mean son of a bitch. You know, like, it's like one person after another was like, you know, he was nice to everyone on the set from, you know, the top to the bottom of the credits. And he just was generous with everyone and stuck up for people. And it's, you know, and it's kind of a recurrent theme. Like, he was a good guy. And, you know,
I say something in the book where I mentioned that, you know, I might have been at the top of the book. I said, even the people who had business disagreements with him and who might have had some kind of conflict about money or about timing or about whatever, those people went away from it, you know, at least after he passed away, they went away thinking, yeah, I mean, that was business. But like, I never didn't like John Candy. You know, you have to be aggressive in business sometimes. And certainly it's never the person themselves. Usually it's usually their agents and lawyers who are nasty to each other. And that says something too, right? So there were conflicts, but they weren't conflicts about him.
You know, like, I mean, there are always going to be conflicts, but it was like, you read this going, I would have liked to hang out with John Candy. That would have been too. a nice thing to do. Did you meet him ever?
You know, I didn't. And I saw him on the street a few times, but I never had the nerve to go up to him. And, you know, and, I was actually at the Toronto Eaton Centre Mall when they were filming The Silent Partner, when I was a little tiny kid. And of course I would never talk to anyone. I didn't see him on that day though. I saw Elliot Gould. No, I saw Christopher Plummer, and Elliot Gould was in that film. By the way, I'm sorry, I got to brag. Elliot Gould talked to me for this book. I mean, that to me, I remember telling my wife, I said, like, oh my God, I'm doing an interview with Elliot Gould. And then, you know, it was a phone interview, and just hearing that voice, Elliot Gould, the original Hawkeye from MASH, you know, like, it's like The Long Goodbye, all these, you know, this guy. And he, like, he's a really great guy. Like, he's got an incredible memory of culture, and also he's very articulate and super effusive about John. And it was just, again, sorry, as a guy who does biographies and traces people down, when I saw that, I had that, you know, once I had that in the can, I was like, oh my God, Elliot Gould.
When I talked to your brother, it was right when, Mike, I was right when Austin Powers was about to come out. He was in Chicago, and it wasn't that long that he made this movie after your father had died. And he was talking a lot about, like, how much that had informed him making Austin Powers, and was talking about you guys growing up. And I pulled it out. He had one quote. He says, my dad loved comedy, loved Peter Sellers, loved Monty Python. He would wake us up at 11:30 because there was a good Peter Sellers movie on, and the four of us, me and my three brothers, would sit in our Jimmy Jams and watch the Pink Panther movies or The Party or I Love You, Alice B. Toklas, or any of those great movies. Is that the kind of thing that shaped your sensibility early on?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I just hearing that back, I smile, because it's like, how lucky was I to grow up with my two brothers and my father. And the thing is, both my parents are from Liverpool, England. So not only is all my Beatles stuff, I'm a huge Beatle fan, I'm a musician, and, you know, all those guys shaped who I am. But then the comedy part, the Python part, and then that led to the Saturday Night Live part, which led us to being just the right age to discover SCTV, which was made like blocks away from our house, maybe miles away from our house. And my dad was such a great bringer of things to us, and like let us watch TV. And then the two brothers, Peter and Mike, Peter brought me Led Zeppelin. Like, he brought it into the house. He brought Led Zeppelin into the house. He brought Talking Heads into the house. So it wasn't one kind of music. And I remember him always bringing Ramones and locking the door in his bedroom and just cranking the Ramones when he was when he was stressed. It was like, so this cultural sort of salon, if you will, of like ideas, and we disseminate these things and deconstruct them. Hugely important. And that's why I think I have a schizophrenic almost, or at least a dual personality about comedy and music. The two things that I write about lately are comedy and music. And the Kids in the Hall was a great example, because they're practically a rock band, you know, like, right. So they were the punk rock comedy troupe. But anyway, so yeah, so my dad, man, you know, just like huge, huge. We still talk about it. Me and my two brothers, we still talk about it. Remember dad said this, you know, and it's a very, I have a lot of gratitude about that.
Yeah, he said that your parents had moved from Liverpool, and that basically, he said, I always thought I was related to the Beatles. The child psychologist, when I was about three, had to have a picture of my father and a picture of John Lennon and say, this is John Lennon and this is your father, because nobody I knew spoke like that except the Beatles and my dad.
Absolutely. Yeah. My dad, in the old days of like landline phones, my dad would call where I was, you know, if I was out too late and I left a number, and it's like, hello, son, you've got to come home now. And it's like, you know, I swear it sounded like John Lennon to me, because, you know, when you're a kid too, you don't know the difference. But yeah, the Beatles were very familiar to us. They felt like our uncles, you know.
Did you at that point think, I want to grow up and become a musician? I mean, obviously you are a musician, but was that?
I did. Yes, I did. Immediately wanted to be of a similar ilk to the Beatles. I wanted to make records, and I wanted to like overdub. I wanted to spend time with reel to reels. And like, I just love the studio, which is kind of where the Todd Rundgren book came from in a weird way. Like, I was just obsessed with how records were made, you know?
Well, I'm impressed that, you know, when you look at the credits for the Record Store Day podcast, it says, you know, written, produced, engineered, hosted, composed the theme music and the, outside music, interstitial music.
I love that word. I always like to say that word whenever I can. Yeah.
Great word. So you're like doing all that, you know, just with your podcast, which is impressive. So
yeah, yeah. I mean, it's also a great outlet as a musician to have something to write music for. You know, it's just like, well, and also control. Let's face it. It becomes so much more of a home run operation that feels very much like the show I want to make. You know, the podcast is, I don't think there's anything on that podcast that isn't something that I would want to listen to, you know?
And you like talking to other artists too, clearly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's the hardest thing for me to not really make it about me talking to them. So what I try to do is inform my questions with a sense of, this is something that I've experienced. I wonder if you've experienced it too, but more and more I'm trying to take the I part out of it and just be like, do you ever find that you're writing in the studio and this happens? And then some of the interviews have been really great, because the moment they understand that I know what a sound check is, even, you know, like the fact that I know what, you know, losing a take means, or, you know, like just little things. I can't think of better examples, but I could tell when they know who they're talking to at that point, they know that they're not going to have to waste their time explaining something, and we'll get to the part that I'm asking about. And if I'm doing it right, that is great. And sometimes it doesn't work, you know? But you try.
Yeah. I mean, and you had some talk shows on the radio before that as well. What is it? Was it 1, 2, 3 with Paul Myers, the Paul Myers show?
Yeah, that was an afternoon radio show. The only great thing about that show, besides the fact that it was super fun to learn how to make radio, was that I got used to making radio. Like, I got used to knowing that you could talk on the mics, as they say, and that it goes out and then you just move on. It's the red light fever goes away pretty fast. And then you start to think about how cool it is to get to, you know, support things and expose, like, say, this artist or this book or this film. I'm going to share that with you. And maybe that goes back to the two brothers. You know, we're sharing stuff all the time. And I think communication and narrative storytelling are like an extension of all that. It might even be part of the songwriting, too. I mean, I think really telling people about stuff. Have you heard this? You know, do you know this? Have you seen that? And it's a job that, you know, never gets. But I wouldn't do it if it wasn't somehow fulfilling, obviously, because it's hard work.
Do you remember the first song you ever wrote?
Yeah, I do.
Well, what was it?
Do you want me to play it?
No, yeah, absolutely.
No, I can't.
I do. Don't ask me that.
It's a single. I don't know. We're doing this over Zoom, so it'll probably get shut off. But what it was is, before I'd even taken guitar lessons, and finally my mom made me take guitar lessons. She paid for it because she said, you got to tune that thing. but I played a single string melody. It was like, it was up and down the, like, one note on the E string, the low E string. And of course, it makes me laugh to this day. As a kid, the first song, first piece I ever wrote, that was it. And I called it Masterpiece. Because already you've hit your masterpiece on the first try. You know, like only a kid.
Even the Temptations waited 10 albums to call something that. But
yeah, exactly. But it just makes me laugh now. But then, you know, I remember also when I started a band, like a basement band, or I was in a basement band. I didn't start it. And they... I brought a song to them, and I'd been listening to a lot of like 70s rock, which was happening when I was a kid, obviously. And I'd never left the basement, but I wrote a song about coming home from the road. Like, it's called Coming Home. And home to my woman, I said. Like, I'm 16 years old.
Oh,
and I'm writing
great.
Home to my woman. So imagine Ian Gillan singing it from Deep Purple. You know, like, it was like, and again, I look at that kid, though, and I just want to, you know, pat his little head and say, good for you, guy. You know, you were swinging at the fences, you know. Because, like, you know, I don't feel embarrassed about it because I feel like it's actually hilarious.
I feel like anything you create, especially when you're young, is like, embrace it, you know. Interesting that you went to Peter the Deep Purple instead of trying to write like little Beatles pastiches or something.
I didn't think I could. The Beatles were so hallowed to me that I didn't learn how to play their songs until my sort of next phase of guitar playing. Because I think I accidentally hit an A minor seventh and went, oh, that's one of those magic chords that I thought nobody could play. And then you realize Paul McCartney was making it up as he goes along, too. So, you know, he was just like ear trained, you know. And so you can learn Beatles songs if you really want to. And now I realize that some of them are deceptively they sound complex, but they're actually not. So,
right. Some of them are like that. And some of them are the other way around where you're just like, wait, there are a lot of chords in this song. It's like it seems like a really catchy, accessible song. But Paul put a lot of weird little chords.
Well, like Here, There and Everywhere is, you know, Cole Porter meets Burt Bacharach meets Brian Wilson. It's everything. And there's like minor sixth, seventh, fifths, ninths, you know, augmented, demented, every kind of chord.
I was just playing with a, like kind of a louder, a friend of mine lent me his Casino Epiphone, and Epiphone Casino, it has a kind of that gnarly sound to it. And I was like, oh, I'm going to try to play, you know, Let Me Roll It, even though I can't really do that. Nah, 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 nah. And I looked it up and it's like three chords. And I'm like, okay, that's one, Paul, where you think, oh, this is like a really great song. And it's all three chords.
And it's all pull-offs too, by the way. It's like, so you just get like, you just go around the fifth fret or something and you just go like, dee-le-ding, dee-le-ding. And it's like, and then you sort of blues out of it, you know, like I could show you. I could.
Yeah,
show,
yeah.
I could.
No, it seemed like something that you could sort of like. Yeah, you put your finger down, you lift it off. I don't have it yet, but I'm very unskilled. Like bar chords are still kind of advanced for me, and I've only been playing for like, you know, 40 years or something.
I'm such a Beatle nerd that I'm in the middle of the McCartney Legacy Part 2, Volume 2, and I read the McCartney Legacy Part 1 earlier, and I'm going through the entire McCartney and Wings career, and just it's fascinating how much is just happenstance, you know, like how much is just he wanted to do this, but that didn't happen, so he did this, you know, like McCartney 2, the solo album, was just because the last album had been really taxing in terms of band stuff, so he just wanted to noodle at home, and he ends up making McCartney 2, you know, like, and Temporary Secretary was just a bunch of riffs because he had a new keyboard, you know, like it's just I love it.
Yeah, no, it's great. Are you still performing in the Paul and John?
Well, no, we haven't really done anything new in you know, 10 years, but I'm starting to write songs again, which is, I mean, real songs. Like, I'm kind of amazed after doing all these instrumental noodlings, and I just started playing acoustic guitar around the house again in a way that sounded like I was writing chords, and then the chords led to melodies, and the melodies, I guess now with the world being as it is, I feel like a little more something to sing about, and they're not necessarily overtly political, but, you know, the songs are about our times and how I feel, and I have no idea what's going to happen with that stuff. But I'm making demos on GarageBand, you know, just I have no idea.
Cool. Well, I'll have to hear them sometime. I'd love to hear that. Actually, not knowing what you're going to do with it is the best way to create. You know, if you're just like, I'm going to do this, you know, it's going to sound like this. You sort of never know what's going to happen anyway. So
I learned from reading all those Beatle books and other books. Like I read the John Fogerty book, which came out a few years ago, but I just read it. And you realize that, yeah, the best thing to do is just put your head down and do it. And you don't even know where it's going to go. And so, you know, you can't, you know. Oh, also, the kids in the hall said something interesting. I said, you know, did you guys set out to be edgy and innovative? And then Dave Foley just laughed in my face and said, if I ever did that, I would never do that. Like, I'd never be able to do that. You can't go into anything with expectations about what's going to come out of it. You know, like, it's just, you have to just let it be and then figure out what to do. You know, so you solve problems as you're going, you know?
Yeah. Well, congratulations on episode 200 of the Record Store Day podcast. What do you get most out of doing this podcast?
Oh, well, you touched on it earlier. For me, to be able to check in with different artists and explore the creative process and in some cases ask people questions that, you know, like you read liner notes for your whole life and then you think, oh, I would like to know how that happened. And then you realize you've got the person there. Like I've got Bonnie Raitt there and I've got, you know, I've had like, I never expected to be talking to The Edge about what it's like to work in U2, and that happened. And then finally I did get Ringo, which was kind of, we had like 15 minutes with Ringo Starr. And, you know, actually I got something good from him. He was telling me about loving Sister Rosetta Tharpe, which I've never read anywhere.
Wow.
And so we ended up having a little chat about that. And it was, those are the things that I take, like I said, someone asked me who my, you know, Godhead interviews would be. And I would say McCartney, Elton John, Joni Mitchell. I haven't got them. I have no lead on them yet. But those three people could talk about all kinds of music plus their own, and it would just be great. I've had Elvis Costello on the show. He's one of my huge songwriting heroes. Actually, Glenn Tilbrook of Squeeze hasn't been on the show, but Chris Difford has, you know. So, you know, and Andy Partridge of XTC has been on my show. So it's I'm getting through a lot of the people that I've always wanted to talk to. So.
Right. And then, and for you, it's just because you love their music and it sort of helps you get inside. Like, it's funny because like there's always this sort of argument like, well, you know, you don't want to analyze the Beatles because you don't want to destroy the magic. I'm like, no, you know what? The more I learn about it, the more magical it becomes. And that's the same thing, you know, listening to one of your interviews, doing one of my interviews for that matter, you just like get more insight. And to me, that's exciting because I love what they're doing. And as I get older too, I find myself more just kind of wanting to celebrate creativity and less wanting to critique it or analyze it. Right.
That you just said it, that is absolutely it. I find myself being way more, open to discussing genres and things that I used to have tribal attachments against or for. And, I had Steve Perry of Journey on, and it was offered to me, and it was talk about a Christmas album, and I'm not generally not excited about those kinds of things. But I realized, you know, this is the guy who sang Don't Stop Believin' that was in The Sopranos, and I get to talk to him, and so let's figure out what it's like for him. And sure enough, we hit a patch together where I felt like we were on the same page, and it was like Steve Perry of Journey, the last person I thought I would ever get to talk to, and, you know, and just... So, yeah, and I don't bring judgments to it anymore at this point. You know, that whole rock orthodoxy stuff doesn't matter to me. I was a punk rock kid. I was also a heavy metal kid when I was younger than that. You know, there's all sorts of things, you know, like you go through periods and now I'm just a music fan.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it was the same with me where it's like, oh, you know, this band used to rock and then they put out like a synthy record and that's no good. And now it's like, whatever. That's what was going on at the time. And
yeah, I remember the backlash on Kiss's I Was Made for Loving You. I remember like, you know, it's like people are going, they've gone disco. It's like, you know, now I just see it as a, you know, sure, it's a disco song for sure. But I mean, it's kind of, it's a Kiss song with a disco beat, you know?
Right. Yeah,
basically,
I was fine.
Neil Bogart's dream, basically. You know?
Yeah, I was fine with Van Halen's Jump. And you did actually mention this in your latest episode, but Black Friday, Record Store Day. I mean, like, how tied are you with Record Store Day? And you listed some of what you're looking forward to. I was just going to ask, you know, if there was anything in particular that jumped out from this list.
I was excited about, I think I mentioned this already, that some of those Talking Heads demos are coming out from the Artistics days when they were a trio.
Right.
The Warren Zevon live concert, I think, is going to be great. I haven't heard it, but the description of it is pretty cool. And
the last one ever.
Yeah, I mean, and it was in Edmonton, and he does a cover of A Case of You by Joni Mitchell. So there's a lot of things. I have to spend more time with it. November 28th is Record Store Day, Black Friday. And the thing I have to do with it is every so often I will suggest stuff to them. And some of that stuff happens. And I tend to write liner notes for it whenever they do a Todd Rundgren project, except not this year. I think they didn't do a liner note this year for the thing, but they have
Is it a cappella this year?
A cappella, yeah. And I either that, or I think maybe they asked during a time when I was finalizing the last draft of my book or something. It was just, but I've been involved with so many of those things and other record store things. And I go to their conference every year and I speak at their conference and I interviewed David Rawlings. I mean, I started talking about Johnny Marr with David Rawlings. I did not expect that. Like he's a Neil Young fan, obviously, but he's also a Johnny Marr, like, completist, you know? So, like, this is what I love too, when you find out that, you know, Jason Isbell's first record he ever bought was Rhythm Nation by Janet Jackson. You wouldn't expect it, but it's great, you know?
Yeah, I love asking people, what's the first record you ever bought with your own money? And it's often surprising. I mean, Record Store Day is cool. I mean, I are you a vinyl nut? I mean, do you play stuff on your turntable at home?
Not as much as you would think, given the job I have. But yeah, because a lot of times I'm so busy getting ready for an interview that I sort of demand the MP3 file so that I can walk around listening to it, because otherwise I wouldn't be able to sit down. And, you know, and then when I've been working on books. So, yeah, so I get copies sent to me, and sometimes, of course, they send me all the Beatles stuff. Whenever this EMI puts out something, I'm happy to be on that mailing list.
Yeah, every fall there's like the new old Beatles thing. But you're not one of these guys who's like, oh, I only want AAA, you know, all analog, you know.
I can't
cut
be.
from the tubes.
I can't be. And I'll tell you, CDs actually still sound good to me, and I'll go to my grave saying that.
But, all right. Know. Well, thanks so much. You know, let's pick this up again sometime. We'll do part 2.
I'd love to. And I've noticed that your podcast is, you're getting great people, and it's really great. So I'm congratulations on that.
That's it for episode 200 of Caropop. Thanks so much to Paul Myers for joining us and sharing tricks of the trade, as well as his insights into John Candy and more. John Candy, A Life in Comedy, is now available from House of Anansi Press, and Myers has been on the road promoting it. He'll be at Pam Cut Tomorrow Theater in Portland, Oregon on November 5th. House of Anansi Press also published Myers' previous book, The Kids in the Hall, One Dumb Guy. The Record Store Day podcast can be found at recordstoreday.com, as well as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other outlets. Myers also has a Substack, the Paul Myers Overshare, at paulmyers.substack.com. That's paulmyers.substack.com. Follow him on Instagram and X at paulmyers, paulmyers. Caropop is produced by Chris Swake, another wizard in the studio. Thanks to all who support Caropop. If you'd like to throw something into the Caropop kitty, we'd be much appreciative, and I'll give you a shout-out on the next episode. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at caropop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caropop on the so-called socials at CaroPopcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro, at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe here and on YouTube, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caropop conversation. Thanks.